Practice makes perfect. Learn Minecraft.
Hi everyone, and welcome back to the Learn Minecraft podcast. Today I'm chatting with the incredibly talented Robert Stacey. You probably know him better as Cynix Design on YouTube. So he's an artist, an educator, and an all-round creative brain, known for making design theory and digital art feel totally approachable. So, Robert, it's great to have you here.
Thank you for having me, Sema. I'm always excited to talk about anything related to creativity and design stuff. In fact, most people, you know, would say I talk too much about all of it because I can't seem to stop anytime I start. But yeah, I'm looking forward to having a conversation.
Well, that's fantastic. It's perfect for a podcast then, isn't it?
Yeah, I would say so.
So let's start from the beginning then. How did you get into digital art in the first place?
Well, I kind of didn't really know what I wanted to do when I was younger. I'm not one of those people that was, you know, grew up in school always sketching or doodling or anything like that. For me, art really came later in life, you know, kind of in the 20s more so. Not like later in life, but, you know, after that childhood period. So I had tried a bunch of different stuff. Originally, I just wanted to do computer-y things, you know, programming, science stuff. And then I got into flying and piloting, which is a weird offshoot, but I just wanted to get into the world rather than being behind a screen, because I think I spent my teenage years just sitting in front of a computer screen way too much. So I kind of was shifting around, going way to one extreme, way to the other extreme. And for whatever reason, just by kind of enjoying, you know, media, books, movies, all that stuff, I was like, well, maybe creativity. And that really is a nice little balance between one extreme of feeling a little bit soul-crushing when you're just sitting in front of a screen, and a little bit of the freedom of flying. And I kind of found that nice middle ground with art. And because I came from such a computer-heavy background, digital art just seemed like the natural place to get into it. And that was back in like 2000. So digital art was relatively new. It wasn't used in the industry much, but it was starting to take off. So I was just happy to get to enjoy watching it evolve.
Very cool, very cool. So have you ever used traditional done traditional art, like use pencils and paper and kind of things?
Yes, but unlike a lot of people, it was like kind of doing putting the cart before the horse, because I kind of started dabbling with that stuff after I was already pretty knowledgeable about digital stuff and had done a bunch of digital painting. But eventually, yeah, it'd be just out of curiosity and out of, you know, the passion that you start to build just from looking at so many amazing traditional artists and painters. I did spend a lot of time, certainly just filling out sketchbooks. I have a huge stack of sketchbooks I filled out, you know, probably 20 or so, you know, just sketchbooks piled up from those years in my 20s, and also getting out there and doing some plein air painting, mostly acrylic. I tried a little bit of everything. I think if I had to go back to it now, I would probably go for gouache. I was trying acrylics at the time, and a little bit of oil, but I was a starving poor person, so not much oil was to be spent by me.
Yeah, it's definitely an expensive medium, isn't it, oil? Because you've got to buy all the accessories that go with it, like the solvents and stuff, don't you?
Yeah, it was a little intimidating when you're starting out. You know, certainly it felt like a big investment, and I wasn't quite ready for it. But I might get back to that someday.
Yeah, I think you should. Oil is surprisingly good, I think. It's, you always get intimidated because you see so many incredible artists using it. But it does, I feel like it does leave a lot of wiggle room for beginners to give it a go.
Yeah, you can just kind of push things around a lot and kind of, get those, you know, it's kind of like playing with butter on a canvas, and you get those nice smooth transitions, and you can kind of build things up, and feels very feels like you have a lot of control in many ways, despite it feeling intimidating.
So, since you tried traditional art after trying digital art, how did that sort of change your perspective of digital art?
Well, there's a couple of ways to look at it, because you know, on more of just a technical side, you appreciate just having, you know, to really feel things and like be in touch with the stuff you're making. But on a different side, it actually traditional stuff improved my sense of color way more. And you might think digital, since you know it's all, you can just kind of pick very precise colors from the entire spectrum, that might help you. But honestly, it was getting into traditional paint and, you know, mixing colors and things of that sort, and really dealing with the colors in a tactile way, that improved my sense of color far more than just having that unlimited freedom that digital provides. It's the limitations that really help you grow and expand on yourself.
Yes, definitely. I think that's right because I've been playing around with limited color palettes at the moment. And as a color pencil artist who has every color, it's been quite a fun thing to be able to do.
Yeah, for sure. I think the first thing I tried to do when I started getting more into traditional stuff was, yeah, start limiting the palette down. I made sure not to buy any paints in the green range, because I was just like, oh, it feels a lot better, especially in plein air painting, to just always be decisive about, oh, I'm mixing yellow and blue and the ratio of them, you know, to create those warm greenish tones and those cool greenish tones. It just really helps you kind of establish your brain in a more color-oriented way.
Yeah, definitely. So when your drawing doesn't look quite right, what's the first thing that you normally check? Is it like the layout or the proportions or the values, or is there something else?
I would say it's always values are going to be number one, I think, no matter what, you know, the overall composition of them. So maybe there's not enough contrast where you want it. Maybe there's too much contrast, which honestly seems to happen more often. Just always pushing contrast too strongly, especially in the digital world. So in that regard, you know, the most important step is to honestly just step as far back away from it as you can. And digitally, that just means shrinking it down. So I always like to look at it as tinily as I can. Tinily, that's not a word. As you know, from the smallest view that I can, you know, I'll shrink things down very, very, very small. So all I can even see are just like some loose collections of shapes of value and things like that. And I know if it doesn't look good at that size, even if I can't make out any of the details, but from an abstract perspective, if it doesn't look good at that size, it's not going to work as a bigger image. So sometimes I'll even correct stuff, you know, at those little sizes where I don't even know what I'm painting, but I'm more so just pushing the value distributions in that sense. And that is always the biggest test and the biggest checkpoint to see if a art piece is working. And of course, traditionally, you know, you can just set it up and then walk as far away as your room will allow you to really see it from far away, and let your eye just digest the values rather than the details or the information of it.
Definitely. I guess that's sort of the equivalent of like blurring your eyes, because I tend to blur my eyes to look at it. That sounds really weird.
Yeah, no, 100%. Like I think I've mastered the partial squint where you get it right to the level where all your brain is picking up on is values and stuff. It's funny, people make fun of me because I'm very like movement based, even no matter what I'm doing, traditional or digital. And there's like a little bit of a physical relationship with like moving a little bit, and like it like lets me focus in on squinting. So I'm constantly doing this like little ducking and weaving motion, and every time I do it, I'm almost adjusting and getting disassociated with my normal view on things, and really getting a good squint and just seeing it as an abstract thing.
Yeah, I can definitely relate to that. So, how do you train yourself to really see what you're drawing from like a structural perspective instead of just copying what's in front of you?
That's a good question because, sometimes when you're starting out, like there is a sense of like almost turning the 3D into a 2D and trying to make sure you're able to coordinate that because oftentimes, like I've found that the opposite is kind of an issue where it's like your brain knows that like a face has form from a certain direction or like anything you're looking at, especially if it's a more, something with like a longer kind of thing. Like if I was drawing a horse and a horse's head is coming toward you, a bunch, it has a lot of movement toward you. So when you are trying to just recreate it, and maybe the horse is looking at you, we always have this tendency to almost fight what we're looking at to make sure that we're demonstrating the actual structure that we know to be where it's like coming forward. And it always gets a little bit wonky. So I wouldn't say the goal for me is always to make sure the structure is being represented because oftentimes I'm trying to make sure I'm not letting my preconceived ideas of what the structure should be almost twist the illusion that I'm creating because it is all illusions, and sometimes those illusions are the things that might be getting a little bit lost. But I guess in that opposite direction, yeah, it's good to just kind of have a feeling of dimension. Even when I'm drawing on a piece of paper and it's just a straight line, it's not like you're going into space or pulling out of space. But in my mind, when I make certain lines, I like to feel like I'm actually going back into space, feeling like I'm going around an object. So one important exercise that I was always big on was just doing like contour lines around any forms, around any objects. When I draw faces, sometimes I would just like to do lines around things, just kind of feel like I'm following it in space, even though it's just a 2D illusion. It feels really good to always be practicing contour lines around any forms. It just kind of gets you in a more 3D form-oriented state of mind.
Yeah, definitely. I definitely see that in your videos because I love your anatomy ones where you sort of go through like an ear and then all the different ways that you can draw an ear, but not just the ways, but all the different 3D structural elements of drawing the ear, and then you sort of like rotate it and draw every side of it. So like how do you sort of think about that in a 3D way?
It's a lot of not getting too kind of overwhelmed by the amount of form going on. So one big focus for me, at least when I started doing the anatomy stuff, it wasn't necessarily about like here's how to recreate, these anatomical forms. It was literally just me trying to keep track of like how you can simplify and streamline the whole thing down. So the whole point of that video series was initially just like here's shortcuts you can take. Here are all the shortcuts of the forms. Like you can take this form and make it into just maybe these couple simple forms, and that will give you enough information to sell whatever you're doing. And it's funny to me because I never considered myself a anatomy, aficionado expert. It's not even the thing that I was ever working as a professional or the thing I was interested in because I'm more of a hard surface. I always loved mechanical stuff and robots and industrial design stuff. But because of that, I kind of then would approach anatomy in this very like, oh, I'm just imagining it as like very simple structures. And it seemed to work okay. People seem to enjoy, kind of learning anatomy in a more, I guess, simplified, focused way.
Yes, definitely. I feel like the way you describe it is much clearer and more concise because it's from a structural point of view, which I personally like as well as an aerospace engineer
Oh, yeah.
formerly. So I really enjoy that that's how you approached it and that's how you spoke about it. It felt way more clearer than like an anatomy book would speak about the bones and the hip joints and all that kind of stuff. So thanks for that.
Yeah, there's you know, I don't think it's a bad thing, but yeah, most anatomy stuff, it'll handle everything, all of the minor little, you know, muscle groups and stuff like that. And personally, I was always of an opinion that, like, okay, that's great and all, but I just want to design a silly character or something. I'm not trying to do fine art, like super you know, well-developed kind of fine art anatomy. I just want to have enough to fake it, create the illusion for other purposes, for concepting purposes, for designing weird proportions and silly costumes and stuff like that.
So I guess following that, so you've also described anatomy as a design tool rather than like a rule book. So can you explain what that means, especially for artists with a realism background?
Yeah, it is kind of interesting because, yeah, my interest in art is really from a concept design kind of background. So I was never too interested in even creating things that were photorealistic or realistic in a meaningful way. The only times I usually have done it is just to practice rendering, see where a little check on where my rendering levels are at. But in my opinion, you know, the goal of art is to kind of make the things we're familiar with a little bit different, a little bit more magical or unique or strange or anything like that, while still feeling believable. I always feel like that's the goal, is to find how far you can push the proportions and shapes and still make it feel almost realistic in a strange way. And that's kind of the more interesting side of anatomy for me, is that little bit of a puzzle. Like, what can I get away with? What makes it feel right? And what makes it feel wrong? And honestly, that question is interesting to me because it leads you down a lot of unique pathways about, you know, aesthetic theory and design theory and everything. And I find it fascinating. You know, it's like, the things that you can exaggerate the most are usually the things that get overlooked the most. So usually when I'm trying to develop styles or, you know, really push proportions, I'm looking at minor things that are usually overlooked when you're just doing art, and then really exaggerating those. So that could be, you know, something like the curve weight of like a bicep on the upper arm or something. You know, you might just kind of try to do it more realistically, and, you know, maybe it just kind of leads to a even apexing curve that's right in the center of the upper arm. But if you're kind of looking for the minor nuance of it, you might notice that that curve kind of like hits down a lot harder closer to the elbow or something. So then you're like, oh, okay, so it's a lot more kind of a steeper drop right in this one spot, and it's not like an even curve. So that way, when you go to stylize it, you can really exaggerate like the offsets of it, the slight, you know, things that break it away from the obvious kind of impression of where the symmetry might be. And you really just exaggerate that type of stuff. And I find that it leads to a place where people look at it and it feels almost more realistic than realism, which I find fascinating.
Yeah, definitely. That is fascinating. That sort of answers my next question as well, about what parts of the body do you think artists overlook? So I find that really interesting. Just thinking about the bicep muscle, you wouldn't necessarily think about that.
Yeah, and I would say, on a more general sense, the things that people overlook the most are those, like, connective offsets of things. So, like, when the most common things I'll see when I look at other artists' work or critique, you know, my students or anything like that, is, you know, they'll have, like, a hand that comes out of a forearm or something like that. And there's no real offset. And if you look at a hand coming out of a forearm, like, it's ever so slightly, you know, it like pushes downward toward the palm side. And a lot of times people will just kind of align things very straight. But I find that you can kind of notice a slight offset in something that occurs at the wrist, and then just exaggerate that even more. And once again, that's one of those things where it just makes it feel more realistic somehow, because our brain kind of picks up on a lot of those subtle offsetting movements, but they're not very obvious. You know, you just look at them and you're like, well, it feels like I could simplify this more in a straight line. And you know, you do that and it feels just a little boring, a little lifeless, and then you exaggerate this very minor little movement, and suddenly it feels lively and it feels dynamic. So there's a lot of things like that where it's like, okay, your hand is mostly, you know, going down the center line of your forearm into your wrist and everything. But if you just like maybe push it a little bit more off to the thumb side and a little bit more toward the palm side, suddenly there's this feeling of structure that occurs around like a wrist that feels so much more fun and interesting and believable. So it's always those connecting parts. It's the shoulders, the elbows, the wrists, the knees, the ankles that I find are the most important and also the biggest weak point, and kind of a place where I can look at an artist and be judgmental about, like, oh, okay, how far along in their art journey are they? Because I notice the really good artists will always have a lot of very subtle little hints and movements and tricks to get those connective parts just right.
Oh, it's very cool, very interesting. I just wouldn't have thought of like those connective parts, like you just said. Wow, thank you. So going back to colors and values then, a lot of artists seem to struggle with their values and how they interact with the colors. So how can you explain how you think about values in your own process?
Yeah, for sure. Now, value and color is one of those things that is also like, you know, very interesting. Once again, every topic in art is like super interesting. I could go on
Exactly.
forever about just color and value, because obviously every color has an inherent value. You know, at its peak saturation, you know, a red is going to be a deeper value than a yellow and stuff like that. And obviously, coming from a digital art background, people, you know, originally were just like, oh, if I want to see what the values are, I'll just take away the saturation. And when you do that, it makes that red and that yellow the exact same. And then you add the saturation back in, you're like, this doesn't feel right. It feels completely different with the saturation there versus not there. And then you have to remember that, oh, yeah, all of these colors actually have an inherent value to them. You know, a blue is going to be a lot darker at its full saturation than like a cyan or something, you know. And then you start to realize, like, okay, yeah, we have our additive, you know, primaries and we have our subtractive primaries. And when I'm painting and coloring, I have a lot of theories about, you know, using the least to do the most amount of stuff. So one of those little tricks becomes if I want to, say, make a gradation from a lighter value to a darker value, oftentimes I will shift the hue a little bit from whatever, you know, if it's like at a yellow, toward a slightly naturally darker inherent value, such as like toward a red or something. In that way, I don't have to change my values as much. But it'll still kind of create a stronger feeling of movement in value just because you're shifting the hue and not really shifting the value too much, but a little bit. But I find that you can use those hue movements to create just a little bit extra kind of finessing of your overall values. And I really enjoy that. I think it makes it a lot more fun because then it feels like you can look at the whole thing and I've barely moved, you know, my values around, you know, on a digital side of things. But I'm getting all of the clarity of those values because of the colors and the saturations kind of carrying those values, which I think is fun and fascinating and interesting. I don't know, color stuff is very interesting. Just from someone that also comes from that more sciencey background, I'm endlessly fascinated by it, you know, as a wavelength, as a thing that is picked up by cones in our eyes, You know, I'm always like trying to analyze it with people, talking a lot about how like magenta is not even a real thing, that our eyes are just making up an illusion for it. Because technically the cones in our eye, the wavelengths don't actually, you know, do that. But whatever, that's a whole other that's a whole other topic.
No, honestly, color is so interesting, and as artists, color is literally our lives. You know, all we do is like play with color and use it to create emotions and compositions and getting people to understand what we're trying to translate. Like a language, color is a language, isn't it? On multiple levels. And that's how artists speak through this language, isn't it? So, because you often use muted colors or like really surprising color palettes. So, is that like quite intentional, or is that sort of something that you've chosen, like sort of done through practice? And how do you trust those color choices as well?
Well, trust is a good word for it because, at the end of the day, aesthetics, design, all this kind of stuff about how we either like or dislike the visuals of something, that's obviously playing to some innate, feeling we have inside of us already. It's not something we need to learn, whether we like something or not. We just kind of naturally look at something and we feel like, oh, I like that. And in general, the way I would describe that and digest that is that the thing that's giving us that feeling of liking or disliking is a handful of different stuff, but I think it mostly comes down to a sense of trust between artist and viewer, a sense of comfort subconsciously in what we're looking at that we can kind of digest it and comprehend it before it even becomes a conscious understanding in our brain. So there's this, a handful of ways to talk about it, but one thing that is very interesting about that aspect of, order and trust being developed subconsciously is that we tend to like it when there's a sense of hierarchy and clarity in things. And that's very important in design theory. You hear about the golden ratio and big, medium, small, and hierarchies of shape. I try to do that with everything. So when we look at an image, we don't necessarily like when it's like kind of ambiguous to us subconsciously, whether it's mostly warm or it's mostly cool. We like to feel like, oh, my brain can identify this is mostly a cool kind of color scheme, and then there's punches of warm tones. Same thing for saturations. We don't like it when, everything's like just saturated or everything's just not saturated. And we don't like it when things are 50% saturated and 50% not saturated, because then our brain is once again looking for which one is actually more represented. And our brain just likes to find patterns. It likes to find structure in things. It likes to understand things from those types of levels. So I always lean into very meaningful ratios that are clear and obvious. So, it's a lot of 70-30s, 80-20s, and that's with everything. That's with cool versus warm tones. That's with saturated versus unsaturated stuff. Always making sure to have a little bit of that represented, and it makes it usually just kind of portray a sense of trust and comfort when you see it, because there's no ambiguity. You can say like, oh, okay, that's mostly desaturated and there's a punch of saturation, or that's mostly cool and there's a punch of warm. And you mix all those things together, and people never consciously will even notice, what I'm trying to trick their brain into. But it will just look good. It will kind of signify all of those little things in the subconscious that are happy to understand and trust in the thing they're looking at. So yeah, it's a lot of that. It's a lot of ratio based balancing of things.
Definitely, especially when it comes to temperature, because I think what you said about the cool and the warm, we like seeing cool and warm together, and it feels better when that is occurring in artwork, and you can sort of tell when someone's used too much warmth or too much cool, and there's just not enough balance. It just feels wrong, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's it certainly feels good to also like almost reward, the brain by seeing like the right, just punch of that thing that was maybe not present. You just give them a real punch of some like bright orange in an otherwise, very mechanical or boring thing, and it just feels exciting.
Definitely. So, how can beginners stop their colors feeling muddy or incoherent?
I think, in my opinion, muddiness usually comes from a lack of, kind of shifting and moving the hues around. The idea that an object has like that inherent color, their local color, and that you're just playing around with values to create light or darkness. I think that's the most destructive thing because that's just not how the world works. Every light has a little bit of a temperature. And past that, every dark area, every shadow has the temperature of whatever ambient color is prevalent around it. So to strip those things away, I think that's where things get muddy. So one good way to easily avoid that is to, kind of do some of those little tricks like shifting the color, the hue around to either every time I'm going lighter, I'll go toward a slightly a hue that has a slightly lighter natural value to it, and every time I go darker, I'll go slightly toward a hue that has a slightly darker value to it, and that seems to make things look a little more lively. Even, in most of the time, we're not dealing with like things that are based on a photo or anything. And we're just coming up with stuff from imagination. So you kind of have to rely a bit more on just, making sure you're using colors and stuff, because it's like you gotta imagine all that stuff. And it's not like you have a bounce light that is necessarily present in this little creature or character you're making. You just have to make sure you imagine that there is one present, and start adding those colors in there, and then usually things won't be too muddy.
So when in the process of your artwork do you start thinking about lighting temperature?
I am a big fan of doing everything very excessively and as crazily as I can very early on, because it's so much harder to go into a painting later on and try to get some like blues into the skin tone or some deep reds into the skin tone. But if you start out with almost a kind of classic style underpainting where you're just doing like super strong, color zones of the face or the skin tones, it's so easy to always dial that down. You could always make it look boring. That's an easy thing. You could just airbrush out all of your crazy colors and bring them back to a very boring, very simple unified tone. But it's so much harder to add in color later on. So I'm a big fan of just getting as weird and crazy and chaotic and experimental right at the start. Don't try to bring it in anywhere later, because usually the art process is just a process of slowly making things more boring as you go along. Just by virtue of rendering, it usually just, it's going to wind up looking a little bit more lifeless than the original sketch and the colors you put down were. So you need to go really far overboard in order to make sure that as you're rendering, it doesn't get too boring along that way.
No, that's very interesting. So I was going to ask about how do you keep your art stylized but still clear and solid? So if you start really crazily, how does that sort of work out for you? Do you have like a mental checklist that you go through?
I have a lot of I have a lot of mental little things that I try to be aware of. But then again, I actually try to do a lot of exercises and teach people a lot of exercises that help them focus on like one particular idea, one particular thing, whether it's like a shape-based exercise to get you to really recognize something about, tension between objects or shape dynamics or just big, medium, small stuff, hierarchy stuff. No matter what, I like to do a lot of exercises that will kind of really fixate on something because when I am then doing stuff in the future, I like to not think about any of that. I like to hope that I put enough little flags into my brain, little mental flags that say, hey, this is important, this is important when I'm practicing something. And then when I go to just draw for fun or make something, ideally my intuition will have kind of absorbed some of that stuff. So I like to always call it and consider it something more akin to juggling, where it's like, at first you have to learn like what it feels like to throw a ball a certain height and to catch it. But eventually the goal is not to improve your consciousness to be keeping track of everything. The goal is to improve your intuition so you don't even have to think about it. You don't even have to be conscious about it. You kind of just develop a memory in the way things feel and the way things go that you can just trust your intuition, trust your subconscious. And that's always the goal in art for me. There's times of deliberate practice where I'm thinking about a specific idea, but when I'm making things, ideally, I'm not consciously worrying about anything. I'm just trusting my intuition as much as I can because I know all of that stuff I'm trying to discover about aesthetics, it's in there already. I'm just trying to figure out, what it is, but it's already in there. And the more I can just trust myself when I'm drawing something to, turn a curve or an angle at a specific point or make a shape a certain size in relationship to another shape, I know if I'm like in a really good intuitive state, that stuff will just occur naturally.
Okay. So, do you think that it's more helpful to, in terms of practice, to like master the basics first, or to learn just by making like big, complete, messy artwork?
I think that is because they both have benefits, honestly. And I think usually that comes down to just how passionate you're feeling any given day. So I always consider passion to be almost like a resource, like a gas tank you have inside of you. And when that gas tank is like running low, when it's empty, like doing a very structured exercise-based thing, like practicing your spheres and different shape drawings and perspective. So that can be, that's something that can burn up a little bit of gas. It's taking a little bit out of you, and you don't want to be running on empty, and because then it's just gonna be ruining things for you in the long run. So to me, it's a balance of like, okay, if I'm already like feeling super inspired and passionate, I'll sometimes be more likely to do, things that burn up that gas tank, such as like a very, a little bit what I might have otherwise considered a boring exercise, but when your passion's high enough, you feel fine with it. It feels good. And then if that passion level is really dropped down and you're feeling a little bit lethargic and you don't want to do these, exercises, that's when I try to refill that gas tank by just having super silly fun with stuff, just making up nonsense, making things just chaotic and silly, just kind of messing around the same way, a kid might do with some finger paints, and just kind of letting yourself have some freedom. And you might find that that passion starts to refill a little bit. That passion can also refill from just, taking a little bit of a break from art and to just absorb other people's art, looking at a lot of art, watching some good movies, listening to some good music, all of that type of stuff. That refills my passion, gets me inspired. And to me, it's just a matter of kind of knowing yourself, knowing is this a good time for, doing kind of more maybe what might be considered a boring exercise, or just having fun and just doing stuff like that. So I try to balance it out in that sense.
No, that sounds really good. It's very similar to what I do. I like to switch between like official practice of doing something specific and then just trying something out. Like I recently completed the Mona Lisa, but doing only three colors. And that was just really fun. It was just something I never really tried to do before, especially that style, because I'm actually a pet portrait artist. So Mona Lisa doesn't have any fur. It's something different. And I get what you mean. It definitely refills your gas tank by doing something a bit more creatively exciting. That's really cool.
Yeah, definitely.
So, if someone is practicing a lot but still not improving, what do you think they're missing?
I think they're missing a little bit of how much they're engaging with their intuition. So, in the grand scheme of things, what I think they might be missing is a little bit of their just observation skills. And I don't mean observing the art they're doing. I mean observing themselves, because what I have found, at least in my experience, is that when I have a bad drawing day, or things feel like they're regressing or like worse, and that could be very demoralizing. You could suddenly be like, oh, maybe I'm just not cut out for art or something like that. But what I find more often than not is if you actually look back and you think about it, usually when you're drawing poorly or you feel like you're not up to what you feel like you should be able to do, it's oftentimes something that is a little bit more overlooked and a little bit more abstract. But I usually find that it's your tempo, your level of focus, your things of that sort. More often than not, when I'm drawing bad, I'll kind of look back and be like, wow, I was drawing really slow, that whole time. It was bad and nothing was looking good. Or maybe I was drawing too fast, or maybe I was too distracted, or maybe I wasn't distracted enough. And we have this like kind of balance. So oftentimes, it's different for everyone, but I'll draw my best if there's a bit of music playing, because it kind of numbs my focus a little bit. And I'll draw my best at, maybe certain times of day when the kind of tempo I'm getting out of my, movements and muscle control is just like kind of getting that right rhythm. And rhythm is very important for, once again, letting your intuition come out, because there's almost like a musicality that we tend to prefer with the way we put down lines and brush strokes, that becomes a lot more intuitive. With certain kind of rhythms involved. We're kind of like snake charming our brain into just letting it be more intuitive, and let it kind of flow out more. And honestly, most of the time when things are not, going well, it just has to do with one of those things. Either our speed and tempo was, a little bit off, or our level of focus was a little bit off, or maybe our just expectations are a little bit off, because you need to believe in the kind of the nature of art. You need to believe that by doing stuff you will get good results, because art is expectation based. At the end of the day, if you don't expect good things to happen, good things won't happen. If you expect good things to happen, they're definitely more likely to happen. So it's a lot of mental stuff, and it's a lot of being able to observe mental states. Which is tricky, because unlike a lot of skills you learn in life, that are just about, doing something technical based on knowledge you've acquired, art is a little bit more nebulous than that. It has to do with things that are too complicated and that will have to deal with your intuition no matter what. You can't avoid it. So you're gonna have to deal with that, and you're gonna have to start observing, things about yourself. But if I can add one more aspect to that, figure drawing, timed figure drawing is a great way to at least start to uncover what your best like drawing speeds and tempos are. Because most people will find that, oh, I don't like the way I draw when it's like 1 minute, timer for a figure drawing, and I don't like the way I draw or the outcome of what I'm doing when it's like a 20 minute or no limit on the timer. But maybe 5 minutes or 2 minutes, it feels like I always make my best stuff right in that time. And that's usually because you feel a sense of, kind of needing to rush or needing to go slow or whatever it might be. But you're finding that speed and tempo that is best attuned to getting your intuition to come out. So it's a lot of silly stuff like that that actually goes into how we feel about our, how we feel about art and how we can achieve the good outcomes that we're looking for.
That how what time works best for you then?
this you even this gets into more nuance and more specific stuff, because there are now I'm just going to keep getting more and more nuanced and nerdy with this. But it depends on the goals that we have in mind. Because in my sense of things, you know, we kind of have a very kind of a state of mind where we're engaging more with absorbing information, and we're not really doing a good job of pulling out information. And from a science standpoint, this has a lot to do with things like adrenaline. You know, when our adrenaline level's high, because of our survival mechanisms, you know, we're trained to absorb things around us. We're trained to just take in stuff and store things because we don't want to be in these situations a lot. You know, like if we're in a fire or a horrible, you know, event is going on, our adrenaline levels spike because it's saying, hey, we got to remember everything that's happening because our survival in the future could be dependent on this. And what also happens when that adrenaline level is high is that our ability to recall stuff becomes horrible. And I've certainly found this out here in Southern California. You know, once when I was younger, I had to evacuate because there was like a fire in my area. And I remember just being like, okay, what am I supposed to bring? And I'm like wandering around this house being like, is this, do I take this? Is this important? Like, I just couldn't think clearly and make good decisions because the adrenaline was just too high and I couldn't recall what matters, what's important. And likewise, the opposite, you know, if you're very sleepy, your adrenaline level's super low late at night or something like that, you can probably think of all the crazy stuff. Everything can come out of your brain. You can have all these weird memories. You can have just ideas popping into your head when you're very relaxed. Right before you fall asleep. And that's why your dreams are always like the most extreme, crazy things, but you don't remember them. You're not going to remember them in the morning. You're not going to remember any of it because your brain is in that low adrenaline state where it's saying, nothing is important. I don't have to remember any of this, but it's pulling out stuff. It's so good at just taking things out of your brain and putting them, you know, out there into your consciousness. So when it comes to doing different types of drawings, it kind of depends because when I'm drawing for the purpose of trying to learn something like practicing anatomy, I need my adrenaline level to be a little bit higher. I need it to be more like middle of the day, you know, sometime where you're more alert. But if I'm just trying to make little thumbnail design ideas, I don't want any adrenaline. I want to be late at night. I want to be sleepy. I want to be out of it. I just want to be making up weird stuff, and getting that stuff. And there's then that whole range of like, what's the goal of what I'm trying to do, and what's the best time for it, and all that type of stuff. And it just becomes, once again, a kind of little puzzle of observations that you have to decode for yourself.
Yeah, definitely. I definitely find that as well. Like working late at night is very different from working in the morning, and then timed as well, like you were just saying. I really like working under pressure. Like I was doing some podcast interviews with other artists where we drew at the same time for only an hour, and it's like, how much can you get done in an hour? And it really does make you focus on the things that matter. And I think that kind of practice really helps you build up, I guess, that knowledge of what matters in it, like in terms of values and what colors really matter, what do you need to put down in terms of structure. And I quite like that kind of practice personally.
Yeah, no, I once again, I find like all of this stuff, you know, endlessly fascinating. So I recommend to everyone, you know, start observing like the times of day, like start putting those little pieces together of the puzzle. Like what situations lead to different results and kind of figure that stuff out.
Yeah, definitely. So what kind of mindset do you think that actually holds artists back the most?
Let's see, what mindset does hold artists back the most? I mean, once again, since expectations are the biggest part of being able to do art stuff, you know, anytime you kind of establish some negativity of any sort, that is a huge danger, you know, as an artist. So you always have to be managing aspects of that. So, you know, the thing that's going to hold you back the most is just, I guess you could say it's like fear or uncertainty or whatever, but just letting negativity be kind of a factor in your brain of any sort. So there are, once again, or as in my endless dive into trying to find solutions to puzzles and things of that sort, I found that like it's very difficult for people to individually try to improve their outlook on their own potential and their own expectations. Like we have a difficulty just being like, I want to, just kind of get into a mindset where I think everything I do is going to be great, and I think everything like that. But what I have found is that by kind of projecting positivity outward, it actually affects the framework of how you will then think about yourself. And that works in the inverse too. If you're like negative about other people's work, if you're like, oh, I'm pretty good, but that person sucks, and these people aren't very good, and I don't really like what they're doing, and stuff like that. At the end of the day, it is going to filter in to how you even see your own work. Because if you don't think other people have potential, then, some part of your subconscious is going to honestly think that you don't have potential either. So the exercises that help the most to kind of build up some positivity toward yourself, even if you're a very negative person about yourself and very pessimistic, is to just project outward, like, oh, this artist I like. I hope they're doing cool stuff. I want to see them keep, progressing and doing awesome work. And I want to imagine them happy. And so all these other artists, and it's so much easier to imagine, another artist kind of being happy and enjoying their work, even though they might be going through the same turmoil. But if you can project that outward and kind of being very positive and commenting on people's stuff and being like, oh, that looks great. I love what you did there. I love this. I love all that type of stuff. Even if you naturally are, kind of more negative about yourself, it's impossible for that to not kind of filter into the way your brain processes yourself and your own work. So much easier to correct things by kind of directing stuff outward than just trying to do it by directing ideas inward.
No, that's a really nice way of putting it. I like the idea of like, because I've always believed in, artists supporting artists. So a way of supporting yourself, you support others, and by putting that positive energy out, you do get it back. And yeah, I like that. That's a really good way of putting it. So
Yeah,
in
and
your
it's
painting,
so true too. I just have to say, it's so I found that it's so amazingly true, because every artist I know that's like really exceeded and become really amazing and talented, they've all done it like while surrounding or like finding their groups, finding their people, being very kind of involved with other artists. It's so hard to do if you're just being isolated or alone, or if you think like everyone else's competition, that's like so negative for your actual artistic growth. So find your communities, be very social and outgoing. It's so important for your own art potential.
yes, definitely. I don't believe in competition when it comes to art because it's just so subjective. Even like, I'm in the field of pet portrait artists. There's a lot of pet portrait artists, but they're not my competition and I'm not their competition because everybody has a different style and a different way of doing things. And I think that's just so beautiful and we should all help each other rather than, I don't know, hide things and
Yeah.
be like, I guess, negative towards each other in that respect.
Definitely. I agree 100%.
Yeah. So going back to your artwork then, your painting choices often feel like they tell a story, even through like your lighting or your detail. So do you do that on purpose or does that just sort of happen naturally as you do it like subconsciously?
I try to just chase whatever happens. I'm a big fan of chasing accidents and being like, well, I didn't intend this to happen, but now that I kind of see it, I'm gonna go with it. So like, I'm never very clear or committed about like what I'm aiming for when I start. I try to always be like, well, if I see something better along the way, I'm just gonna keep it. I'll just change. I'll just chase whatever feels right. And I find that that's very important because it also helps you, not be too precious or committed with anything you're doing, which is once again one of those ideas in art that's so important. They all say to like, kill your babies and do all this stuff and be very, detached from the work you're doing. And it's not in a negative way detached. But more in a optimistic way that like everything can wind up in places far beyond my expectations, you know, better and more interesting than I would have ever planned or thought of. So I'm big on just letting things go where they may and not really knowing and just enjoying that feeling of exploration and adventure with even color choices or little shapes or everything in a painting. Everything can have its own little, you know, freedom to it and kind of find its way as it goes.
So, do you like to take apart your own style then and like sort of just see where it goes just to shake things up? And especially, I guess, if it's getting predictable, if you're doing the same sort of figurative drawing over and over again.
Yeah, I mean I'm a big fan of like I think to a detriment where I just want to try different like something completely different every single day I sit down and start drawing. Like it's not been good for me in a career sense because I'm, you know, kind of a jack of all trades, master of none type situation. But I love it. You know, it's just more fun. I don't like trying to get really good at one specific thing when I could just be having so much fun learning as many things as I can and trying as many things as I can. So it has its drawbacks for like, you know, the kind of capitalist nature of trying to make a living with it. But it doesn't matter. It's, you know, if I wanted to just make money, I wind up becoming an artist anyway, so no point in trying to, you know, rewrite that now.
So let's talk about your setup now. So, what does your digital setup look like, and what tools do you think are essential, and what tools do you think that people use too much?
That's tricky because I don't want to say people use stuff too much when maybe they just have a different experience with it than I do. Like personally, you know, my setup is literally like this little cartoony looking tablet that's adorable and it just makes me happy when I see it. But you know, I could have a fancy, you know, Cintiq and like all the more higher end equipment. But I like just keeping it simple and letting my tool be just something to be mastered for all of its issues and all of its shortfalls, than to just try to find a place where I don't have to, you know, deal with any of that. So early on in my art learning time, I went to like a fun little workshop. And I remember there was a really good oil painter, I want to say John Foster. And I remember him saying very clearly when someone asked him about like he was using like this beat up brush that looked awful. It just looked horrible. And he just said, "Oh, the best art is always made with the worst brush." And he said that, and it just kind of stuck in my brain forever to the point where I'm like, I understand what he means because it's more about just both embracing whatever limitation is placed upon you, but also like kind of turning that limitation into its an advantage to some regard. So the biggest there's not like a big downfall of like techniques or you know things people use. It's more so that they have a kind of misunderstanding of what value, you know, certain things can bring to them. Because you don't need much, you know, and it's kind of good to just use like a cheap thing and see how far you can go with it. Even for traditional stuff, you know, I used very cheap, crappy paints, but they allowed me to understand like what their limitations were. Like, why do you need to have better paints? What do they offer me? Or, you know, because if you just jump straight in to high-end equipment and the best of everything, you know, that feels nice and, you know, it feels good. But you're not going to quite understand what they offer and like what they're, you know, what the other side of things is like. And there's value in that. And sometimes, you know, you might find that the crappier paint and the worse tools are honestly kind of where you might have the most fun and might give you interesting, you know, outcomes. But yeah, for me, I use a very simple little cheap tablet. And I also mostly use that because as I get older, like physical health becomes more of an issue. And certainly having a tablet that I don't have to look down at, obviously you can have a Cintiq that's in front of you and that has gives you good posture, but I just find that this is very comfortable ergonomically. I can look ahead at what I'm doing. I can draw, completely detached but in sync, and it feels really nice to do that type of stuff. The only big thing I would give to everyone in terms of like, oh, you might be using a tool that's making you worse, would have to do with like physical health stuff. Like, don't use a, a screen tablet that you're looking down at all the time. That's just bad for your back and your overall health in the long run. And same thing for like Apple pencils and stuff can be a little bit dangerous unless you kind of give some grip to them because you don't want to have something that is slippery in your hand when you're drawing. You want to feel like you don't have to put any pressure in your fingertips to hold something. So you always want to make sure your tools are doing good things for your long-term health because pressure in the fingertips is the biggest destroyer of all of your health. So you got to remember that, like, oh, if I need to press hard into something, I'm squeezing my fingertips. So you got to make sure your sensitivity levels are like very high because you never want to be putting pressure in your fingertips. If you ever feel pressure in your fingertips when you're drawing because you're pressing hard or because, the thing you're using is too slippery and slick and you have to do that, that is a big thing to just look out for. Avoid that. You should never feel like there's any pressure in your fingertips when you're drawing.
You should avoid being a color pencil artist
Well, I'm sure you can. I don't know. Yeah, maybe. I don't know. That those do seem very slippery now that I think about it.
then. Yeah, I do. I'm very heavy-handed, I think, when it comes to color pencil. I even had to buy some compression gloves that's used for like people with arthritis in their fingers, and man, that helps a lot if you do have issues with that. Anybody who has issues with their fingers. Compression gloves are fantastic. I only have to use them sometimes, not all the time, but learning to have a lighter touch is definitely healthier.
Yeah, for the long run, certainly. Yeah. But
Yeah.
yeah, do what you can. Yeah, compression glove. If you have to hold them because yeah, colored pencils or something. Yeah, just make sure you're aware of that and you're doing whatever you can to, counteract that.
Yeah, definitely. So, is there like a common belief about digital painting that you think is outdated or unhelpful, and what would you suggest instead?
Huh. That's a it's a complex idea. I don't know of anything off the top of my head. I mean, there's a lot of like little tiny theories that like digital art can kind of mess you up on because of once again the full control you have over value range and stuff. Because obviously in real life, you never want to go all the way from like pure white to pure black, in a single image because it can just really feel discordant with how your eyes work. Your eyes just don't pick up that range naturally. We have a limited range that our eyes can absorb at any given moment. So, there's little things like that, but there's not like a big issue that I, am generally aware of that comes to digital art stuff. I don't know. Yeah, I guess I don't have a good clear answer for that one.
No, that sounded good though. Yeah, it's hard to think of these things at the top of your head. But no, I like that. So, Robert, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. It's been very inspiring and a really interesting chat. So, if you're not already following Cynic's design, go and check him out now. I've popped the link down in the description below.
Yeah, thank you so much, Sama, for letting me hang out and yap for a while. Because once again, I just love talking about this stuff. It's my passion. More so, I mean, the weird part about me, I guess, is I like talking and dissecting it kind of more so than I like making stuff, more than having the product of it at the end of the day. Which, I mean, I guess that's good that I went into teaching and stuff because I just find it so fascinating to just talk about creative stuff. So yeah, thanks a lot for letting me talk to you about it.
If you've enjoyed listening, remember you can watch this podcast with video and no ads at learnmycraft.com, where you'll also find animal art practice journals, books, and tutorials to get you started. Hit subscribe and follow the podcast, and we'll see you next time.